Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Don't forget, we send a podcast to you for free every day. If you sign up, go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show, and you can podcast one segment of this show every single day for free. Now, sociologists have studied racial identity and class differences, of course, but which takes precedence, and how do they mix? In America today, we are defined more by our class, or are we defined more by our race? My next guest actually tries to answer that question, at least for one group, middle-class blacks. Think the Huxtables from Bill Cosby show, maybe? In her book, Blue Chip Black, Race, Class, and Status in the New Black Middle Class. Karen Lacey is an assistant professor in the departments of sociology and the Center for Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan, and she joins me now. We'll also get her reaction to some statements that Clarence Thomas made on 60 Minutes that are really right on point, and we'll play those clips. And Professor Lacey, welcome to WNYC. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
So you open your book with the example of the fictional family, the Huxtables of Brooklyn from the NBC Cosby show. How much did the question of how realistic that show was originally inspire your work?
Well, there certainly are a number of scholars who have used the Cosby show as one way to talk about the importance of race and class. Although many people enjoy The Cosby Show, critics argue that the show did not accurately depict the black middle class.
And in what ways that are important for equality and justice in America?
Well, one of the important contributions that The Cosby Show made to our understanding of the black middle class and the black class structure more generally is that it shed light on a group that we hear very little about. We hear quite a bit about the black poor and about the black working class, but the group that is featured in The Cosby Show is virtually unknown. Blue Chip Black provides a window into their lives.
How do you define the term Blue Chip Black? Was that your choice of words for the title?
Yes, it was. The title refers to blacks who move back and forth between what I call the black world and the white world. They do not live exclusively in a racially distinct environment. And in order to move back and forth across this color line, these blacks develop a unique set of strategies that are outlined in the book. So what makes these blacks blue chip is that, unlike lower class blacks, unlike the black poor, they work in predominantly white environments. Many of them live in white neighborhoods. Many of them have attended white colleges, and some of them have never experienced economic hardship.
What kinds of strategies were you referring to?
Well, I set out to understand these strategies by looking at three different types of communities in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. These communities are not typical residential locations for black people. One is a majority white community, which I call Lakeview, located in Fairfax County. This community is made up of only 4% black people. Black people make up about 4% of the population. The second community, which I call Riverton, is located in PG County. It's 65% black. And the third community, which I call Sherwood Park, is also located in Riverton, also predominantly black, but is upper middle class. And the book looks at the different ways that people who live in these communities think about what it means to be black and live out their lives as black people in America. I learned from my interviews with them and from my observations in their communities that these blacks think about their lives in terms of many social identities, and race is not the most salient identity all the time.
So you looked at how parents define their children's identities, and did you find that middle-class parents go out of their way to give their children a racial identity?
Yes, I did. I find that these parents are very concerned about race. It matters greatly to them. The parents were all concerned with nurturing a black racial identity in their children, in part because they knew that their children, once they became adult, would be either living in white neighborhoods or working in predominantly white environments. And in fact, their children have many more interactions across the color line than the parents themselves did when they were children. So the parents spend a huge amount of time helping their children to remember that they are black, even as they attempted to provide them with all of the advantages that middle-class children receive in American society. But there are also aspects of class that are not the same as black. So there's an emphasis on race in some settings, and there's an emphasis on class in other settings. The workplace is a good example of what I mean here. The people in my study believe that work is one place where race shouldn't matter, where race shouldn't come into play. So race shouldn't affect how you relate to a subordinate at work or how you manage a conference call. For people in positions of power, work is the place where a class-based identity is more relevant than a race-based identity.
So, listeners, we can open up the phones if you identify with what Professor Karen Lacy is talking about. Karen Lacy from the University of Michigan, author of Blue Chip Black, Race, Class, and Status in the New Black Middle Class. 212-433-WNYC. Are you what she would describe as a blue chip black? And do you teach your children about what it means to be black in America today? Should you? How do you? Would it be better for parents to raise children to be, quote, race neutral, as some say? And in your experience, does a middle class status protect African Americans from discrimination? A lot? A little? Not at all? Call us and react to anything that Karen Lacy is saying. If you identify with it, what issues does this raise for you? What stories do you want to tell that you think are important and pertinent here? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I want to play two clips from Clarence Thomas on 60 Minutes for you, because they do seem right on point. Did you happen to watch it last night, Professor Lacy?
I did.
So here is one that gets right to it with the question from the interviewer, Steve Croft.
How much of your life is determined by your race?
I don't know. I'm black. You know, how much of your life is determined by being male? I have no idea. I'm black. That's a fact of life. I'm 5'8.5" tall. I don't know how much of my life is determined by being 5'8.5" tall. It's just a part of who I am.
But you think of yourself as a black man.
I'm a man. I'm a man. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, I'm a citizen of this country, and I happen to be black. I am a human being.
And you know, Professor Lacy, one of the interesting things to me about that answer was that he seemed to bristle a little bit at being asked how much being black defines his life, as if to say, well, you wouldn't ask a white guest how much of your life is defined by being white.
Right.
What was your reaction to that?
Well, I do think that some elements of Thomas's response are accurate. It is true that there are some aspects of everyday life that are similar for all people who are middle class, regardless of race. In terms of occupation, educational attainment, income, to some extent housing, the top segment of the black middle class, which is where Clarence Thomas falls, is certainly equal to the white middle class. But the key distinction between the white middle class and the black middle class is this. Middle class whites fit the public image of the middle class, and as a result, they are free to take their middle class status for granted. But middle class blacks have to work harder, much harder, more deliberately and more consistently to make their middle class status known to others. Clarence Thomas is well known in American society, and for that reason, he may not need to do as much work as the anonymous black person does in order to signal to others that they are middle class.
Right. And here's the other Thomas clip where he really does get to how much he was not protected from racism, even by being admitted to a prestigious educational institution, in this case, Yale University.
And I honestly believed that Yale thought that having a kid who came from working people in the South, who had grown up through segregation, that this kid who'd prospered, who'd done well every single place he'd ever been, whether an all-white school, all-black schools, he'd always done well, he will do well here, and it will benefit both him and Yale. That's what I thought. Now, that's what you do when you're 21, 22 years of age. You could make a mistake. Well, that isn't what it was converted to.
What was it converted to?
It was converted to, well, you're here because you're black.
Common story, Professor Lacey?
Yes, I think it is. The people who participated in my study and the findings that I report in Blue Chip Black were also very concerned about the degree of discrimination that their children would face. And that's one of the reasons why race was so important to them and why emphasizing a racial identity was so important to them. They didn't want their children to ever forget that they were black, in part because race matters in the larger society. So they drew a distinction between the kinds of strategies that they would employ within their suburban communities, where their neighbors knew them, knew their economic status, and of course knew their children, versus the strategies that they would use in more public spaces. And by public, here I mean while shopping in stores and workplaces, while moving about in the D.C. area, and certainly in white universities and other institutions.
What about your experience at the University of Michigan in this respect? U of M has so been in the center of the storm when it comes to affirmative action, trying to maintain certain affirmative action programs that the Supreme Court has struck down, or in some cases upheld, but in some cases struck down. Now the voters of Michigan going after University of Michigan affirmative action programs. But in your experiences as a professor there, did students at the University of Michigan experience that same kind of dynamic that Clarence Thomas was describing at Yale?
I have not heard students express that dynamic. I do teach a course on race and ethnicity, a large lecture course to undergraduate students at the University of Michigan. And many of the students, black and white, saw the need for a continuation of affirmative action policy at the university level, in part because most students and most Americans generally believe that everyone should have a fair shot. Everyone should have an opportunity to move up the class ladder. And there's an awareness among college students that not every racial or ethnic group has a fair shot.
Do you think there's a difference at a state school like the University of Michigan than at an elite private institution like Yale in how people may get treated?
I suspect that there is. What we don't hear from the Thomas interview on 60 Minutes is what his colleagues thought about him, the other students at Yale or the professors there. So we hear Thomas's interpretation of what others mm-hmm. must have thought about him, which is certainly important. But the other side of that is the perspective of people who interacted with him while he was there.
My guest on WNYC, Karen Lacey, who teaches in the Sociology Department and the Center for Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan. She has authored the book Blue Chip Black, Race, Class, and Status in the New Black Middle Class. And let's take some phone calls. Our lines are full. Cheryl in Denville, you're on WNYC. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Professor Lacey, first of all, I had to call because not only am I a native Ann Arborite, I got my MBA at the University of Michigan. I've lived
Oh, great.
On the East. Go Blue. I've been on the East Coast, though, for several years, but I really was compelled to call because, first of all, while I do admit that I did not hear the Clarence Thomas interview, I will say that my experience at the University of Michigan was very empowering. I happened to have received my MBA in the early 90s, and I was there at a time when there were more African Americans in our business school class or in the business school than there had ever been, and I dare say probably have been since. But it was a wonderful experience because, again, I don't know what his experience was at Yale, but we had such a large population at the time that we were pretty, I'll say, self-sufficient and didn't need to reach out to our majority mm-hmm. counterparts is often we had people who were expert and brilliant in every single area that you can imagine. So when often, you know, you were shunned and not included in study groups with white students, frankly, we didn't feel the need to have to do that. Mm. So that was very empowering for me.
And you also wanted to talk about your family situation, how you teach your kids.
Uh-huh. Yes, I'm sorry to get off track. One thing that I did want to say, as a middle-class black family now, I will say that I think that there really is an emphasis among me and my peers to really emphasize our blackness more than maybe prior generations. I think, you know, a lot of us live in predominantly white communities. We have professional jobs. But that said, you know, we choose to affiliate with a lot of black middle-class organizations because we are often socially isolated. And we find that it's a very empowering thing. And I think that I personally go out of my way to emphasize my blackness to my children more than was probably the case with me. I think we're more secure in who we are, and prior generations probably worried more about assimilation. I think we're very confident with who we are and what we have. We don't separate being black from being part of a community. It absolutely defines who I am. But, you know, I'm very comfortable moving in and out of either community. But, again, it's something that I really emphasize, and I feel a sense of pride when my children can speak comfortably about being African-American and seeing African-American role models around them and speaking very positive about their experience while interacting very comfortably with their white friends and students.
Professor Lacey?
Yes, I certainly agree with your comment. In the book, I talk about why it is that the respondents expressed an affinity for not only black organizations, but also black spaces more generally. And they were interested in these spaces because they spend a large portion of their day at work, working in predominantly white environments. And these black spaces are opportunities for black professionals to reconnect with other blacks. So the predominantly black community that I mentioned, Riverton, is one way that black parents help their children to experience a black community. So that is a residential location. But the black professionals who lived in the majority white community also sought these kinds of opportunities for their children to interact with other blacks. They couldn't do it in their neighborhood because they were often the only black family or one of a few, and they couldn't be certain that their children would meet other black kids. So they turned to black social organizations. One popular organization is Jack and Jill.
Cheryl, thanks so much for calling and opening up to us so much about that. Thank you. And Ed in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Ryan.
Go ahead. We have a bad cell phone connection, I think, but take your best shot.
I think hopefully you can hear me. What I'd like to say is, first of all, my wife and I are a big fan of yours, and we commend you for your unyielding willingness to address some of these most challenging issues.
Thanks so much.
My wife and I are both second-generation blue chippers. She's a psychologist. I'm an attorney. We live in the suburbs. And we experienced our parents passing down the lessons of having to be better and setting an example because we were uplifting a race to going through college and graduate school and Ivy League and very competitive institutions in the 80s, where, in fact, there was this backlash and this presumption that we were only there because of our race and having to overcome that. And as we're raising our own children in the suburbs, where we have a daughter who's only one of two black children, she's very comfortable in her skin, is very empowered, recognizes that there is more than one world that she lives in. Our concern is that we don't exist in a vacuum, and her white counterparts and peers have absolutely no awareness of their race, their racial implication, their racial history, and quite frankly, the inherent latent privilege that accrues to them at every single stage. And so for as much progress as we've made as blue chippers, we really are fighting an uphill battle because the broader society is not really talking about race, particularly for those people who see themselves as individuals first.
Ed, thank you. And I'm going to move on because our time is getting very short. But Professor Lacey, it sounds like there's a lesson in awareness here for white people as well as self-awareness for black people.
Yes, there certainly is. The first lesson is that there are people who there are people in our society like the Cosbys. That is quite shocking to some whites who have no idea that that there are middle-class blacks, upper-middle-class blacks, who live in highly desirable neighborhoods, communities, who have ascended the occupational ladder, and who are doing as well in terms of economic indicators as many middle-class whites are. But that doesn't negate the fact that there's still quite a bit of discrimination that is directed even towards these highly accomplished blacks, and they're keenly aware of that.
And this class-based casual privilege that you mentioned before and that I think Ed was getting at, that a lot of white people don't even realize that we have. I think it's easier for a white person to dress down in the workplace and not have to worry about being accused of being not serious, to take a small example.
Right. There's a section of the book where I talk about how attentive these blacks are to clothing, to language, to mannerisms, as a way to signal that, in fact, they are middle class. They are not members of the black poor. To signal this identity to white strangers who know little about them other than the first impression, what they see before them at first contact.
Let me get one more call in here real quick. Samantha in Orangeburg, we have about a minute for you. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, how are you?
Good, and you?
I'm good. I'm driving up and down hoping that I don't lose my connection. But what I was going to say is I grew up in a very white town in Massachusetts. We were the only black family on our block, and the people who lived next door to us moved out when we moved in. My brother and I were raised, my parents didn't accentuate race a lot, and I'm not doing that with my children. And my father and I talk about this phenomenon of black people who go home at the end of the day. And I'm wondering if you come across any people who don't feel obligated to accentuate that, who don't feel like there's such a huge dichotomy in where they live and where they work. And did you find any families like that?
Professor Lacey, we have about a half minute left.
I did not come across any families who were not concerned about race at all. There were certainly members of this study who were concerned about race to a different degree. Some parents did more work than others, but there were not any respondents who didn't think about race at all. But keep in mind that this is a study that was conducted in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., where, you know, there's racial stratification, there's class stratification, and so these issues may certainly be more salient in Washington, D.C. than they would be in other regions of the country.
A lot to think about, a lot to learn from Karen Lacey, L-A-C-E, author of Blue Chip Black, Race, Class, and Status. L-A-C-Y, I think I said
it's
L-A-C-E.
Okay.
It's Lacey, not Lace. And the book is Blue Chip Black, Race, Class, and Status in the New Black Middle Class, published by the University of California Press. She teaches at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, preliminary results of our group journalism project, Are You Being Gouged? And a follow-up assignment for some of you. Stay tuned.